This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The National Basketball Association crowned a new champion on Thursday night when the San Antonio Spurs beat the Detroit Pistons 81-74. The NBA had previously announced a new agreement between the players and the league that will, among other things, prevent high school players from trying to become the next Kevin Garnett or Tracy McGrady. And as if that's not enough, it's time to talk about the impending NBA draft that will inevitably vastly improve some lucky team and leave several others second-guessing themselves, perhaps for years. Joining me now on the line from San Antonio, the site of Games 1, 2, 6, and 7 of the NBA Finals, is Jack McCallum of Sports Illustrated. Jack, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
With San Antonio's Game 7 win over Detroit on Thursday, the Spurs have now captured 3 championships over the last 7 seasons. I guess talk of a dynasty would be a little silly since the Spurs won in 99 and then again in 03 and now 05. But if it is a dynasty, there has been some criticism. It's the dullest of all dynasties. What do you think?
Well, the talk of a dynasty is premature, but it's not that premature for this reason. This is a team whose business plan is incredible. They have the core of their team locked up until the year 2010. They have an attractive place to play, no matter what people says about boring. They always manage to get a free agent or two to fit around them. Mm-hmm. So if you took one team right now that is in great shape in the NBA, it is the San Antonio Spurs. They will come back next season, the season after that, the season after that, as at least one of the favorites. And there's not many franchises that can say that.
In your Sports Illustrated cover story this week, you point out that it's a shame games 1 through 4 of the series dissuaded a lot of people from even tuning in game 5. Why?
Well, just after I wrote that, everything kind of turned golden in this series. The first 4 games were all double-digit margins by the winner, by the home team, and it seemed to sort of prove everything what everybody thought about the NBA, which is they don't play hard. You only have to tune in the first quarter, fourth quarter, and the home team always wins. All that was obviated in games 5, 6, and 7, and in between there, they also got a labor agreement. So they had an incredible bit of sunny news in this final week of the NBA Finals.
Does 3 good games constitute an exciting final? It was a 7-game series. And how does it compare to, say, the best, most exciting final you've ever witnessed?
Well, it doesn't compare to that because this is a game that has always been sold by its personalities. As much as we used to say, oh, gee, the old Boston Celtics were so great because they played team ball, the game was sold on the backs of Bob Cousy and Bill Russell. Later, it was sold on the backs of Larry Bird, Julius Erving, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson. That's how this game appeals to the American public. The stars right now, the MVP of this finals on Thursday night was Tim Duncan, just does not resonate with the public. And you have to admit when you go into that, when the personalities don't rivet you as they did in the past, it's almost by definition that the finals aren't going to be probably as exciting, and they certainly won't be to the public at large.
Earlier in the week, as you mentioned, the NBA agreed on a new deal with the union, and a lockout will apparently be avoided for at least the next 6 years. The changes include a minimum age requirement of 19, shorter contracts, smaller annual raises for players. Did the players concede too much?
I don't think so. I mean, the players, if this thing would have gone, the first thing you have to remember, if this thing would have gone to be a work stoppage, the public did not, they don't care the issues. Their bottom line was, we don't want these guys with an average salary of, between $3 and $5 million walking any kind of labor stoppage. We don't want it. And the fact that the owners are getting rich has never translated, to the public. They just don't care about that. So this was a league that both sides really realized that they needed to get a deal done, particularly in light of what hockey did not do. So I think that was the number one thing. They got a deal done. I think it was fairly equitable, and what we are focusing the most attention on, and I mean the media also, is this age thing, and frankly, I don't think it's that big of an issue, and I think it was a compromise issue from the beginning. I think the league was going to come down to 19, and I think the players were going to come up from 18 to 19. I think that was sort of decided, you know, a year ago.
The NBA draft will be held in New York on Tuesday. How, if at all, does the new age requirement affect this year's crop of draft hopefuls?
Well, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't take effect for these guys. For once, we are coming into a draft where there's actually going to be college players, apparently, at the top of it. Andrew Bogut from Utah, Marvin Harris from North Carolina will probably be the first two picks. Frankly, it's a little bit of a mediocre draft. And the one thing that the high school players did do was add some spice to it. I mean, the year that LeBron James came in, you know, that was sort of the big news. And I don't mean to indicate there won't be any effect, but the guys you mentioned correctly, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant, particularly LeBron James, who have jumped directly from high school to college, okay, there are some of them, but it's not every year you're going to get a LeBron James. For example, this year there wouldn't have been one in that class, so they're just going to have to find something to do for a year until they become draft eligible.
All right, Jack, you have characterized San Antonio as the best prepared NBA team for the future. Do they meet Detroit again in the NBA Finals next year?
Well, you know, Detroit, to a large extent, is the same way, that their general manager, Joe Dumars, who was a part of two championship Piston teams in the late 80s and early 90s, has also fashioned a team that kind of has looked ahead to the future. There's one big difference, and that is we don't know who's going to be coaching this team. Larry Brown, you know, one of the all-time greatest coaches, but rather somewhat of a Hamlet figure in the league. Larry has some health issues that he's going to be looking into, and they at this point, we don't know whether he's going to be back or not. So that is obviously a big thing. I'm not saying they won't win without Larry Brown, but right now I'm going to reserve judgment on that. We'll see if Larry comes back.
Jack McCallum covered the 2005 NBA Finals for Sports Illustrated. He joined me on the line from San Antonio, from which city he will be joining us to discuss the 2006 Finals as well. Thanks, Jack.
Okay, thank you.
Formula One racing, which is enormously popular all over the world, features cars that resemble rocket ships and, according to Steve Ballard, who covers auto racing for the Indianapolis Star, cost about as much to make.
It's the best car money can build. There aren't budgets. There aren't really any limitations. You can spend whatever you have. And, you know, a typical team budget for one of these top teams, Ferrari, is like $400 million, $500 million a year. When you see one of these cars, you're seeing just the, you know, it's the Swiss watch of, you know, of a racing machine.
Unhappily for those attending Sunday's U.S. Grand Prix race at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, 14 of the 20 Swiss watches of racing failed to tick. When the safety of the Michelin tires with which those 14 cars were equipped was called into question during preliminary runs, the tire company told the seven teams it supplies to switch to a different model. The rules governing F1 prohibit the switch Michelin had suggested. Nobody blinked, and when the race was supposed to begin, 14 drivers pulled their multi-million-dollar machines back into the pits. Six cars running on Bridgestone tires went on to race. Among the racing fans who felt cheated was Bob Motis of Fort Wayne, Indiana. He'd brought his dad and his 9-year-old daughter to the track for Father's Day.
My daughter, she started crying. She didn't quite really understand or realize that that was going to happen. So, you know, I had to get her to calm down, and my dad just couldn't believe that, you know, this was happening to people that paid so much money to sit there and watch it.
Bob Motis says he'll still watch F1 racing on television, though he's not sure he'll pay to attend the event if it returns to Indianapolis next summer. Still, he's optimist enough to suggest that something positive may have come from Sunday's embarrassment.
There's many different ways to look at what happened. You know, right now, Formula One's the talk of the country, so they definitely succeeded in making more people aware of the sport, but just, you know, in the worst possible way.
Remarkably, some fans of Formula One racing have gone beyond jokes about trying to make the best of a bad situation. According to Ron Green, the director of public relations for Indianapolis Motor Speedway, they've been buying tickets for the next F1 event at Indy, though it is a year away at best and may not happen at all.
Monday brought a new day, obviously, and our building was scheduled to open at 8 o'clock, including our ticket office. We begin selling tickets for the next year's event the day after that respective race. And we had fans lined up at 7:30, more than 30 deep, and that line swelled to over 100 throughout the morning, and a majority of those fans were renewing tickets.
Unhappily for the Speedway, the Michelin Company, and F1 racing in general, some fans haven't been so forgiving. Bill Daniels, another F1 fan present for the disappointment on Sunday, hopes to hit the sport he has loved in the pocketbook.
I'm suing for all the racing fans. Racing fans are probably the greatest fans in the world. They'll sit through bad weather. They'll sit through bad races. But what happened Sunday was certainly intolerable. And I want the penalty severe enough that no team or any event will ever think of putting the fans through what they went through last Sunday.
Maybe one or more of the lawsuits being filed will encourage the people who run F1 to take steps to avoid another race in which only 30% of the drivers on hand participate, or maybe not. Steve Ballard thinks the whole industry needs retooling.
I think they really do need to take a look at the entire structure of the sport, and somebody has to be in charge. Somebody has to be in a position to make a decision and say, this is what we're going to do. That's what was so lacking here on Sunday, that, you know, what we were joking about in the press box, if Bill France Jr. was here, this would get fixed. You know, he's the president of NASCAR, and right or wrong, you know, when there's a problem, Bill France Jr. fixes it. And there needed to be something that didn't allow it to turn into the, you know, absurdity of what it did.
While the ramifications of that absurdity continue to percolate in this country, the F1 drivers have repaired to France, where they will race next weekend. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, athletes positively blinded by the goal ball. But first, when pro football players wear logos the league doesn't like on their sweatbands, or pro baseball players throw chairs over the bullpen wall, they are fined. The fines often seem inconsequential in terms of the percentage of the miscreant's salary they represent. In a recent Wall Street Journal article, staff reporter John Weinbach reveals that those fines may be considerably less consequential than they have seemed. John Weinbach joins me now on the phone from Los Angeles. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Please summarize for me what you learned when you began investigating how often penalized players actually pay their fines.
Well, it may be a surprise just to most casual sportsmen that all the leagues have kind of appeals setups for any fine or suspension. And basically what I found is what a lot of people have long suspected, is that behind closed doors, after the loud proclamations of discipline have been made, deals are struck. And, you know, we found in the NFL, a third of all fines are reduced. The NBA, not surprisingly, does not announce how much it fines and how much it collects, so it's impossible to find out the discrepancy between the two. And baseball also has a long history of forgiving fines. One of the more notable ones, which we cited in the story, is the case of John Rocker, you know, who in 2000 made those famous comments off color and was fined, you know, $20,000 and suspended. And, you know, 2 months later, without a whole much of fanfare, fine was reduced to $500. Suspension was reduced to, you know, half, so he could pitch by opening day. What's interesting about that case is that baseball, of the four major sports, the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, and NASCAR, baseball by far issues the smallest amount of fines and almost never announces fines publicly, unlike, say, the NBA or the NFL. In that case, they did, and even the power of the media couldn't help them keep the fine intact.
I guess it could be argued, though, that even though Rocker didn't have to pay the $20,000, he did pay in various other ways for his indiscretions and stupidity.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly paid in the court of public opinion, and, I mean, let's look at where his career has ended up. He's now pitching and struggling for the independent league Long Island Ducks out of Central Islip, New York. Last check, I think in 17 games, he was 0-2 with an ERA over 6 and
Oops.
5 wild pitches. So he's not exactly on the all-star team. But at the same time, I think it is important to note that leagues do have these appeals processes set up for a good reason, in the sense that nobody expects them to be kind of these Stalinist regimes where no one can speak up. I mean, they should have, players should have the ability to appeal, but the idea is it shouldn't be kind of a free pass almost every time an appeal comes that it's going to get reduced.
Now, yeah, you do write that the National Football League doesn't make the news public when it reduces or rescinds a fine. Do players, coaches, league officials, the whole bunch of them, regard the whole process as pretty much of a joke?
I don't know if a joke might be a strong word. I mean, you know, there are plenty of cases where a player feels a fine is too harsh. He'll go say, I think it's too harsh, and the league will say, no. I think, again, it's the contrast between how public they are when they announce the fines and how private they are in reducing them. I mean, you know, in a criminal example, you'd always hear, maybe not get the exact details, but you would hear that a deal was struck in the case of, you know, Kenneth Lay or whomever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
The same standard should be held for athletes, particularly because their misdeeds often happen more publicly than anyone else.
NASCAR fines its drivers for breaking various rules, but one of the fellows you spoke to, Chip Williams, who advises
yeah.
several top drivers, characterized that process as, quote, sort of like a really good mutual fund. What did he mean by that?
Well, NASCAR has an unusual system where they actually pool the money that's fined from drivers and crews for everything from installing illegal windows to a temper tantrum in the pit after a race to swearing on national TV. They'll pool all those fines, and at the end of the year, based on how the racer finishes in the top 25 point standings, give it back. So last year, Kurt Busch, who was the NASCAR points champion, his team, that is to say, not just him, you know, his crew chief was fined, I think it was $21,000. Because he finished first, he got the largest chunk of the whole fine pool and got back $84,000.
That's an excellent investment.
That's a pretty good, you know, return on investment. and what is the larger point of the story is, I don't know if it's hypocrisy or a lack of transparency about the discipline process, that sports leagues come out very publicly and very loudly, in the NBA's case, very sternly, and penalize bad behavior and never reveal that, you know, hey, a lot of it comes back to the athlete.
Well, NBA players are sometimes fined by their teams for
Correct.
Showing up late for the bus or missing practice, something like that. Tell me what you found out about how the Dallas Mavericks handled players who'd been fined for say, missing the team bus.
Yeah, well, I was at a practice in Los Angeles late in the season and was talking to a bunch of different players, and Jason Terry and others revealed that, you know, then-coach Don Nelson, who's since stepped down, he's kind of from the old guard and had that attitude that, you know, this is the player's money and it belongs to them, so they should earn, you know, the right to get it back. So instead of just collecting the money, he had a shooting contest at the All-Star break. And, you know, based on how many shots you made from certain spots on the floor, you could make money back. And we're talking, you know, hundreds, even into the thousands of dollars for, you know, everything from missing a team bus to being tardy to practice, you know, what have you. You know, certain guys were able to make enough shots to make money back. In baseball, in particular, a lot of the players will have their own quote-unquote kangaroo court,
mm-hmm.
Where they'll penalize guys for, you know, not tipping the bat boy or making a really stupid play on the field. But again, that's not team-imposed discipline. That's more sort of in the spirit of fun.
Right.
The big difference.
You mentioned another interesting example in your article. Shaquille O'Neal learns that he's been fined $10,000 at one point, and his response is, la, 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 only $10,000. Is this, did players generally respond this way? They regard the whole thing as kind of a minor inconvenience?
Well, it's certainly a lot easier to do that when you're making $27.6 million, which is what Shaq's take was, I think, in 1999, and it's even higher now. It's tough to say. I mean, I think, for the most part, a lot of athletes don't want to part with any money. Oftentimes, they have to be prodded to tip the ball boys or what have you. I just think that many of them feel that the league discipline is sort of random and that a particular sport may have it in for a certain guy. Certainly, you know, Randy Moss feels that way from the NFL. He's been fined so many times. But, you know, as far as the financial impact, I think it depends. Obviously, a guy who's making $1 million who loses $100,000 is going to feel that a lot more than a guy who's making $10 million.
Among the people you talked to for your article was former baseball commissioner Faye Vincent, and he told you the whole process of fines was, quote, a charade. But has he or anybody else come up with a better way to hold players to a reasonable standard of behavior?
In baseball, it's a very difficult situation because the league's Players Union is so powerful and has had such a strong record in litigation and collective bargaining, and they've won the right to appeal all these fines, and they've won the right in collective bargaining to limit the league's ability to fine guys no more than, say, $2,000 for any infraction. Several people sort of told me that oftentimes a team will call the players' union and say, how much can we get away with in terms of a fine here before you're going to appeal? And it's a negotiation even before the discipline is announced.
Wow.
And that's really what it's come to. A lot of times that's true in pro basketball and in the NFL, where there will be kind of a pre-negotiation about the extent of the penalty, especially from the team side. I mean, one of the other things that we actually just didn't have the space to get into is the whole gray area of team fines.
Mm-hmm.
And team fines, there's usually far more wiggle room because the team doesn't want to antagonize the player. He may be a free agent and they need to sign him. So there's really no way to document the flow of money there at all.
John Weinbach's article, When Players Don't Pay, appeared in the June 17th edition of the Wall Street Journal, and he joined me from Los Angeles. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Craig Biggio, whose quest to achieve the title of Major League Batter Most Often Hit by a Pitch I discussed on last week's program with the proprietor of the website Plunk Biggio, made news this week. On Wednesday, Biggio was nailed by Jason Jennings of the Colorado Rockies. The Plunk was number 266 and moved the bruised and battered Biggio to within one of Don Baylor, who owns the modern record. Biggio's Astros are playing the Texas Rangers this weekend. The pitcher scheduled to start for Texas today, Chris Young, has never hit Craig Biggio. This weekend, teams from all over the U.S. are competing in the National Goalball Championships in Colorado Springs. Goalball was a highlight of the Paralympics in Barcelona, Atlanta, Sydney, and Athens. The game is played by blind and visually impaired athletes, but now the sighted are seeing what all the excitement is about. Judith Ritter saw and heard the reigning Paralympic champions at a recent practice, and she has this report.
Quiet, please. Play.
On a highly polished floor about the size of a volleyball court, a 4-pound ball streaks along at speeds of around 40 miles an hour. Two teams of three players each hurl the ball toward a goal box at each end of the floor. The players wear plastic chest protectors and hockey goalie pads on their knees and elbows, and each padded player wears blackened ski goggles that make it impossible to see. The athletes blindly fling themselves down and slide on their sides across the slippery floor as they try to block the ball with their chests, arms, and stomachs. Goalball looks like a combination of extreme bowling and postmodern dance. The object is to keep the opponent's ball from going into a goal box that extends the entire width of the court, about 27 feet.
To really place yourself purposefully in front of a ball that's coming at you from certain players really fast, it takes a certain amount of willpower to say, okay, I'm lying down in front of this ball.
That's Brendan Golan, a big, handsome football player-sized teenager.
And it's really scary sometimes. The first time I watched, I was, like, terrified. I'm like, I don't want to stop these shots.
Brendan's fear is well-founded. As he speaks, Vivienne Forêt, a wiry blonde woman from the number one-ranked Canadian national team, is crunched over in pain. The ball has just hit her in a rib that she broke stopping the ball with her chest in an earlier game. Goalball is rough and aggressive, and it has been since it was invented to rehabilitate U.S. soldiers blinded in World War II. The game demands upper body power and incredible cardiovascular endurance. Some of the players practicing here today are members of the Canadian national women's team that grabbed gold in Sydney and in Athens.
What?
Nathalie Chatron is one of the most skillful players in the world. She says the sport requires more than physical strength. It demands intense concentration and highly developed listening skills. Though the basketball-sized goal ball has bells inside and jingles as it zooms across the floor, there are ways to put a silent spin on it.
So then you have to listen only to the shh of the ball, the rubber of the ball on the floor only. And at the same time, you have to listen to the other players to see if they did move. So you have to listen to their steps, even their breathing.
Sighted players can be at a disadvantage because their listening skills aren't as acute as those of blind players. Another disadvantage is that sighted athletes are not allowed to compete at the international level.
The only practice I get without my sighting is on the court. So they get used to listening, and since they don't see, they hear more details than I do.
Goalie Laurence Tetreau is sighted, and she's been playing for 2 years. She says learning the game in competitions with unsighted teammates and opponents is daunting.
The first year I played, they used to tell me, Laurence, it's coming like right in front of you. Laurence, it's coming in diagonal. Laurence, it's... And I was like, what? How can you see that? How can you feel that? So they're used to, you know, hearing the trajectory of the ball. They're more likely to have precise knowing of where the ball is than myself. I think maybe it's a combination of the other senses. They merge for doing the goal ball sense. My ability to listen has improved a lot.
But even the most gifted unsighted players can't rely on listening all the time. In a qualifying game in England for the Paralympics, gold medalist Natalie Chartrand tried to give a congratulatory pat to a teammate's backside. A congratulatory pat that landed instead on the rear end of an Olympic goal ball official.
And everybody was laughing and everybody was talking about number 8, Canada, grabbing official bump.
Undaunted, Chartrand and her team went on to win the game. And the next, and the next. This coming September, the best teams in the world gather in Sao Paulo for the Pan American Games. The trophy for the World Goal Ball Championship is up for grabs again in 2006, and the National Association of Blind Athlete Finals are this weekend in Colorado Springs. For Only a Game, I'm Judith Ritter in Montreal, Canada.
10 seconds for Fifi.
You're listening to Only a Game. Paula Krebs, who hears Only a Game on WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, and R. Gordon Talley, a WBUR listener, are among those who wrote this week to applaud the story about the Slaterettes on last week's program. This would seem to bode well for the future of women's baseball, at least in southern New England. James Crist, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore, wrote this week to say that he was, quote, shocked to hear that Only a Game uses anonymous sources. Mr. Crist was referring to my conversation last week with Mr. X, who runs a website dedicated to Craig Biggio's pursuit of the record for number of times hit by a pitch in a major league career. I thought public radio was better than rags like the Washington Post, Mr. Crist wrote. What next? James Blair inventing a story about, say, women's baseball in Rhode Island? Oh, you did that already? I'm so confused I don't know what to believe. If you insist on using an anonymous source, at least give him a respectable nom de plume, e.g. Deep Bruise. Bill Morris, who hears the program on Public Radio East in North Carolina, was among the listeners who enjoyed W.D. Wetherill's commentary on last week's program. As a fly fisherman, writer, son, and father, I implore you, make Mr. Wetherill's essay available on your site. That was some good stuff. Finally, Mark Cole, who listens to Only a Game via the Internet, wrote, "Most shows I not only laugh at and with Charlie Pierce, but generally agree with him. However, I disagree with his contention that Ichiro's accomplishments in Japan were on the AAA level. Wouldn't a more comparable example be the Negro Leagues? And the statistics for players who played in both the Negro Leagues and later the Major Leagues were factored into their elections to the Hall of Fame. I know Charlie doesn't put much stock in Halls of Fame in general, but in this case, I think he was off base." Should you wish to disagree or agree with Charlie, or contact Only a Game for any other reason, though I can't imagine what it would be, our postal address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us directly through our website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Harlem's best-known export enjoys a recent resurgence in popularity. But first, the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
By virtue of their 81-74 win over Detroit on Thursday, the San Antonio Spurs are the 2005 NBA champions. The series went 7 games, so would you like one last chance to change your opinion about this year's NBA Finals?
Games 5 and 6 were terrific games. Game 7 was a very well-fought, if not artistically played game. By and large, I'd say I give it a C-plus for a series. Big points for Greg Popovich and the San Antonio Spurs, who really did rise to the occasion.
I thought you were going to say you can dance to it. It had a beat.
It did not have a beat. That was the problem. The first 3 games did what they could to kill the beat.
The 2005 draft will take place on Tuesday. Andrew Bogut worked out this week for the Milwaukee Bucks, who hold the #1 pick. The former Utah center dressed in a suit and presented Bucks owner and U.S. Senator Herb Kohl with a resume. I hope there were no misspellings. I sure hope the suit was properly pressed.
Well, I, for one, am glad that we're going to get to say the name Andrew Bogut for the foreseeable future as we go around the Only a Game calendar. He's the only real center in the bunch. He will get drafted first. He will go to Milwaukee. I can tell you from personal experience he will have a good time there. The flavor of the month is apparently Marvin Williams, the kid from North Carolina, who has, as they say, the great upside.
The NBA and the union agreed this week to a new 6-year deal. The current sports labor trend seems to have owners enjoying the upper hand. Is that the case with this agreement?
Considering that both sides agreed to sell out the rights of people who they don't nominally have anything to do with, it was an easy thing to agree. And, of course, most of the noise is what I'm starting to call the College Basketball Protection Act of 2005, which is the age limit, which has a couple of enthusiasts. One, people who think Jermaine O'Neal and Amari Stoudemire and Kobe Bryant are all bad for the league. The other one, who seemed to be the college basketball fascisti who perceive their product to have suffered over the last couple of years. I still can't believe this thing will last past the first person who takes it to court, but we'll see.
Annika Sorenstam is in the running. Going into the final rounds of the U.S. Women's Open, she will be one up on Tiger in the major wins category and 3/4 of the way to her goal of a 2005 Grand Slam. If she wins, you think that's likely?
Well, is she entered in the tournament?
Silly question.
Then she wins. We explained this all a couple of weeks ago. They're having charades. Annika wins.
Has Sunday's fiasco at the U.S. Grand Prix done anything to prevent you from considering a nickname change from Mr. NASCAR to Mr. Formula One?
Well, I'm considering changing it to Mr. Formula One since the job appears to be open. They managed to put a 6-car field together for the U.S. Grand Prix because the Michelin Tire Company couldn't ensure the safety of its driver because of, quote, an unreliable tire design.
Not something
which doesn't
you
matter
want.
You and me and everybody else driving to the gas and sip, but when you're going in excess of 200 miles an hour, that could be a problem.
Last weekend, F1 president and CEO Bernie Ecclestone called to congratulate Danica Patrick on her 4th-place finish at the Indy 500, and then he repeated a sexist comment for which he had been criticized before. Is this the sort of leadership F1 needs at this point?
Well, it certainly sounds like the kind of leadership that would change the name of F1 to FU. he referred to women as, quote, domestic appliances, which I think in the year 2005 is something one ought not to say to the biggest star your dying sport has.
The Association of Tennis Professionals, otherwise known as the ATP, will soon hire a new chairman of the board, which I'm sure will rescue men's tennis if Etienne de Villers' past experience is any indication. What do you think?
Well, he comes from that enormously stable organization we like to call Formula One Racing, oddly enough. But his quote was great. He says, "I know enough right now to be absolutely lethal," he said. "Let me loose right now, and I'll kill the sport." Wow.
Sounds like a resume to me.
Way to take over the new job.
It's been quite a week at Wimbledon for Maria Sharapova, who had no trouble with her second-round opponent on Thursday and achieved a personal best in her first-round match.
A 101.2 decibel grunt.
Unbelievable.
Which was probably audible in Piccadilly Circus.
Monica Seles, you're #2. Reports surfaced early this week that the National Hockey League and its union could announce Excuse me.
I'm sorry, am I being boring?
No, it was this question. I couldn't get through the sentence without yawning. Anyway, there is one provision in the new collective bargaining agreement which would give each NHL team the right to buy out any existing contract and not have it count against their salary cap. Will the NHL free agent frenzy become an annual event?
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that, but it's a demonstration that the that NHL management is coming out of this with the whip hand. You can buy out any contract you want and have it not penalize you in any way. That means that you're insulating your management and your general managers from the consequences of any of their own mistakes.
At least once.
Right.
One huge mistake can be erased. Newly hired Chicago Blackhawks general manager Dale Tallon got right down to business on Tuesday and fired the head coach, Brian Sutter. Who would have won more games over the past winter than Sutter?
I think Brian's done a great job in the lockout myself. I think he's done as good a job as anybody else in the NHL. I wonder how many times the Sutter brothers have been fired.
We should start counting that up.
I'm
sure it's a record. Last week, the Columbus Stars youth baseball team was ousted from a recreational league in Canal Winchester, Ohio. I guess it's just not true that everybody loves a winner.
No, they were thrown out because they were too good. They won their last three games by a combined score of 55-0. Sugar Grove won, however, managed to put together two runs against them, and then nobody wanted to play him anymore.
And finally, Charlie, on Tuesday, the Korean Baseball Association stunned members of South Korea's eight professional baseball teams when they decreed that cabbage leaves could not be considered a part of a normal baseball uniform. Why? Why this draconian measure?
Not just not considered part of a baseball uniform, but they should be considered as, quote, odd materials. Apparently, word has gotten around that Babe Ruth used to wear a cabbage leaf in his hat to cool himself off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would point out that Babe Ruth also used to drink 153 beers to cool himself off, but that's neither here nor there. And Park Myung-hwan of the Doosan Bears fell down, and his hat came off.
Maybe it was the beers.
And a frozen cabbage leaf came out. And he said he began using them last year because he heard from some local TV station that Babe Ruth used to use them.
Charlie Pierce, sans cabbage leaf, joins us each week at this time. He's a writer for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. Asked once how the team he managed, the Harlem Globetrotters, survived the Great Depression, impresario extraordinaire Abe Saperstein replied, "All the banks were closing, so we went where there were no banks." Over the years, the Globetrotters also found their way to London, Hong Kong, and 104 other countries, not to mention various editions of Madison Square Garden in New York. In Spinning the Globe, subtitled The Rise, Fall, and Return to Greatness of the Harlem Globetrotters, Ben Green presents the history of the Globetrotters. He joins me now from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Mr. Green, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. I'm glad to be here.
When the Globetrotters first began playing, basketball was a decidedly minor presence on the sports landscape in this country. To what extent did the Globetrotters contribute to really popularizing the game?
Well, I think they had a huge influence on the modern game of basketball. I mean, in the early years of the NBA, the early 50s, the Globetrotters were a much bigger draw than the NBA. And if you look at the game today, the NBA is playing Globetrotter basketball. I mean, where did Showtime come from? That's pure Globetrotter ball.
It's interesting. The relationship between the Globetrotters and the NBA is very complicated. On the one hand, Abe Saperstein was outraged when the NBA started signing players who otherwise would have been Globetrotters. But on the other hand, the NBA, as you point out, still needed the Globetrotters well into the 50s to bring people into their buildings.
Right. I mean, Abe had a monopoly on the best black ballplayers in the country, so he stood to lose more than anybody when the NBA integrated. But at the same time, the NBA would have the Globetrotters play double headers to draw a crowd. And as most of the old timers would say, as soon as the Globetrotter game was over, the arenas went empty out. People didn't come to see the Sheboygan Redskins. They came to see the Globetrotters.
Partly because they were very talented and partly because the opposition wasn't always entirely authentic, the Globetrotters built some exceptional winning streaks. But tell us the story of the night that they actually lost to the Washington Generals.
Right, right. In some ways, that was the first harbinger of their fall, of their decline that has now been reversed, thankfully. But in 1971, the Washington Generals with Red Klotz actually beat the Globetrotters in Tennessee. And the way Red Klotz tells the story, normally they would let the Globetrotters put on the show, you know, do the confetti in the bucket. But Meadowlark Lemon decided he was going to beat them bad that night. And as Red Klotz would say, it didn't work out that way. Klotz actually hit a game-winning shot and rushed his team off the court because, as he said, the fans were really shocked. It was like killing Santa Claus, he said, for the Globetrotters to actually lose.
Numbers of the Globetrotters playing in the 40s and 50s talked about how overseas they were embraced by fans, and then they'd come home to a country where they weren't welcome to eat in some restaurants or sleep in some hotels, and yet, ironically, various U.S. administrations considered the Globetrotters wonderful ambassadors. Did the Globetrotters ever feel manipulated?
You know, when I talked to the older players who were traveling the world, to them, they were just so thankful to get to play ball. I mean, to them, they were playing basketball, and they noticed the difference, certainly. They clearly saw the difference of how they were put up in the finest hotels in Paris and Rome, and they came back to Des Moines or Biloxi, and they couldn't even get a hamburger. But I don't think they really realized the political implications of how the U.S. government was using them, really as a propaganda weapon in the Cold War. And to me, that was one of the really enlightening paradoxes about the Globetrotters, that they're sent around the world as ambassadors of goodwill to really contradict Soviet propaganda. And yet when they come home, you know, they can't even stay in a hotel. They can't live where they want to. They can't eat where they want to. So those kind of ironies run throughout the entire history of the Globetrotters.
To me, perhaps the single most intriguing Globetrotter was Marcus Haynes, the man who could stall a game indefinitely by dribbling the ball. He was the first Globetrotter with a college degree, also the first person in his family to get a college degree, and he probably needed basketball much less than some of his teammates on the Globetrotters did, and yet he was associated with the Trotters for decades. Why did he stay with it?
Well, he loved basketball. I mean, I think that's the driving motivation for all these guys. And Marcus was a true artist. Still, I mean, the guy's still alive. He's in his late 70s, early 80s. But I think Marcus had more influence on basketball than any single Globetrotter. He truly revolutionized ball handling, did things with a ball that nobody'd ever done before. I mean, today you go to a Globetrotter game and the Generals players or the New York National players, they're letting the dribblers do it. Marcus would actually take over an entire game when the other team was trying to get the ball away. He once dribbled out an entire fourth quarter down in Mexico. They were playing at altitude and two other players had fouled out. He just took over the game and just said, come get the ball. And nobody could get the ball away from him. And in later years, guys like Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, would look back to Marcus Haynes and say, this is the guy who inspired them about what you could do with a basketball.
You know, one of my favorite stories in your book actually involves Marcus Haynes' dribbling ability while he was still in college. The coach was not exactly a fan of that display,
right.
But tell us about that a little bit.
Well, Marcus was playing in a college tournament, and he decided that he was going to show what he could do against this other team, which had humiliated a team coach, believe it or not, by Jackie Robinson. And so with a few minutes left in the game in the fourth quarter, Marcus goes into his dribbling act, which no one had ever seen, and his own coach had no idea what Marcus could do, but he was an old school fundamentalist. He sees Marcus out there on one knee, sliding around, dribbling the ball, and the coach went crazy. He actually charged the court. He started chasing Marcus around the court. As the gun sounds, he sidesteps his coach, goes in for a game-winning layup, and kept running. The coach chased him all the way off the floor, saying, you'll never play again.
Now, lots of wonderful athletes and great entertainers have played for the Globetrotters, but there seems to have been a pattern whereby some of the most spectacular entertainers would alienate themselves from the rest of the team. Meadowlark Lemon would be the best example of that syndrome, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting talking to players about Meadowlark. I mean, Meadowlark really became the superstar of the Globetrotters after Goose Tatum, who frankly I believe was the central character, who really developed the kind of comedy ball that Meadowlark capitalized on. But the players themselves had a very complicated relationship with Meadowlark, partly because the guy could not play basketball. That was the thing to them that kind of undercut his credibility. But it turned into the Meadowlark Lemon Show. They were all really subservient to Meadowlark, who was this, you know, worldwide celebrity. So they had a very, really kind of complicated love-hate relationship with him.
Well, you write of the early 70s, quote, in the context of what was happening in America, it was hard to take the Globetrotters seriously. How did the team survive an era in which what they were doing was attacked as Uncle Tomism and the reinforcement of insulting racial stereotypes?
They went downhill. They didn't really survive. By the 1990s, early 90s, they were dead in the water. I mean, the team was on the verge of bankruptcy. People saw them as really a bygone era, a relic of the Jim Crow era, and they really didn't have a place or an identity anymore. And I think if not for the turnaround in the last 10 years, they would have gone on the shelf in the museum with a lot of other relics of, like, the Negro Leagues that really their time had passed.
Well, as you say, the current team, under the ownership of former Globetrotter player Manny Jackson, is thriving. They're doing just fine. Has the show changed?
You know, they still do some of the greatest tricks from all time. I mean, they still do the confetti in the bucket. But the first thing Manny Jackson realized he's got to do, he had to get back to good basketball. He really did a house cleaning. He said, we're going to go back to our roots. We're going to become a good basketball team that can also clown, not just clowns. And so he's actually, over the last 10 years, made an effort to go back and play competitive games the way the Globetrotters did 30, 40 years ago. It's still a terrific show, though.
Ben Green is the author of Spinning the Globe, The Rise, Fall, and Return to Greatness of the Harlem Globetrotters, published by HarperCollins. He joined me from member station WUSF in Tampa. Ben, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help from Ernie Villarreal at KSTX in San Antonio and from Tom Dahlenmeyer at WUSF in Tampa. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Spinning the Globe, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bill Daniels, who personally witnessed the U.S. Grand Prix last Sunday.
I'm sure that Michelin tires won't be big sellers in central Indiana for a while.
Is that the reason that the big roly-poly Michelin man looks so sad in recent TV ads? I'm Phil Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.